So this is part five of the series, and it's the last one of the specific series on trauma. The next 3 weeks, we're still going to have a session. We're just going to be doing three different one-off topics, which I haven't fully decided what they are yet, so stay tuned. But before we start, I also want to just remind everyone about Purim. Purim is on Tuesday, 9:30. Now, I just need to mention that it's almost for sure that the address is going to be changed. So it's still going to be in Vaucluse, but it'll be at the house, the home of Kim Elster. I'll put it on the... Just if you could just watch your WhatsApps, and I'll know today or tomorrow, and I'll post it on the broadcast and things like that. You'll be able to get it, but... Oh, and I'll send an email around as well, so just stay tuned. But it will be on Tuesday morning, Purim, 9:30, Purim hour. Okay. Just a very quick review of last week. If I sound half dead today, it's because I was at a wedding last night. So please forgive me. I'll try to get into it with time. It was many hours and more than one l'chaim. So, anyway, so last week we talked about the work of George Bonanno in the work of resilience, the idea that actually more people are resilient than we think, and the fact that we tend to look, when we do the studies, we tend to look at the problem people. We tend to look at those people who are suffering from PTSD, and that's where we do the research, and that's where we sort of build the strategies from. But his idea was, his thesis was, you need to look at the people who didn't suffer from prolonged PTSD and see why. And that's what he did, particularly in the study, many studies, but particularly in the study after 9/11. And he came with this whole idea of different components of resilience, optimism, confidence, and seeing challenges, seeing things that happen which are potential threats as challenges to be overcome, and so on and so forth. And then we talked about some of the work of Tal Ben Shachar again, of looking at not just resilience, but resilience is bouncing back to where you were before, but really to actually grow. This whole idea of PTG, which is post-traumatic growth, to actually grow, and that links into the whole idea of purpose, which we're going to talk about today. Okay, so what I want to do today is complete the discussion on, well, it's not complete because it's an ongoing discussion and very complex discussion, but just sort of incorporate a final idea, so to speak, in the discussion that we've been having on trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder and the damage and the challenges that come from trauma and the healing, right? We'll be talking about the different components of healing from trauma. So I think it's really important, especially as... the fact that we always try and incorporate the Jewish perspective, it would be a very incomplete discussion if we didn't add in a very, very important component, which without that component, I think, it becomes much, much harder to heal. Right? In other words, it's a certain perspective we're going to talk about that makes it easier to do all the other things that we've been talking about the last few weeks. Meaning the other things are important, as we're going to talk about in a minute, but they become much more easier. The determination, the drive, the confidence, the conviction that we have to heal and we can heal, and we have that choice to heal, as we talked about a few weeks ago, that idea of bechira, mere choice, is all supported and can be supported and can be driven by the idea we're going to talk about today, which is two things which are already one. It's the concept of faith and values and purpose. Right. Now, as I said, it doesn't mean faith, having faith in Hashem, faith in God, is the only thing a person needs to heal from any traumatic experience or any challenge. That's not true. I mean, everything we spoke about is really, really important. We need connection with other people, as we've gone into great detail. We need physical well-being, we need mindful living, we need hard work, we need therapy. And maybe some people need psychedelics. But all of that, as we spoke about, maybe... in fact, it's becoming probable that maybe there are people that nothing else will help. But it doesn't matter. Whatever it is, it always needs hard work, and it always needs all these things and all these components of healing. But to be determined to do all those things, to want to do all those things, to get the help, to get the therapy, to get in the mindset of mindful living, to put in the effort to make connections with other people, not to be trapped in who we are, not to let the trauma define us, or the challenges to define us in any way, that becomes much, much stronger and much, much possible, much more possible when we talk about the concept of faith and purpose. Now, before we get into some heavier stuff, faith and purpose is also not only part of the healing process, but it's part of the prevention process, right? You see, purpose, real values. Because purpose really comes, when we talk about living with purpose, it comes from inner values. You know, we always talk about this idea of the difference between living inside out or outside in, right? Outside in is we define ourselves by what happens on the outside. We define ourselves by success. We define our happiness by things that come from the outside and so on and so forth, which is really a bad way to live. But the real true way of living is inside out, where we start with our core values, our core purpose. And everything that we do afterwards is defined by that, right? When we have purpose, that purpose becomes an anchor. It becomes an anchor that we are strong in, and it sort of becomes the guiding, consistent principle of the things that we do, and makes it easier to navigate the challenging and the ups and downs, because the purpose always remains constant, right? We said this a lot during COVID, that situation changes, external circumstances change, but our purpose, our core values don't change. I'll just a little break with a little nice story that I just heard recently. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was a kinos, a gathering, like they do with the men early on in the year, they do with the women, the Chabad Rebbetzins of all the years, of all the world. They come and they're gathering in Crown Heights, and it's this huge convention, a number of thousands of them. So my wife was listening online, and then she shared with me the story of the, I don't know her name, I've forgotten her name, but it's the Chabad Rebbetzin in Shanghai, China. So you can imagine it's a different set of challenges there. But so she told a very interesting story. She was asked to speak at one of the sessions, and she shared the story about what happened to her and her family during the COVID experience, which was in China. If you think we had it bad, China was crazy, right? So, first of all, she got locked out of China when the whole thing broke, because she was in New York, and they closed their doors, and she wasn't able to go back. So for 7 months, they got stuck in New York, she and her husband and her, I think, seven children. Yeah, seven children, the oldest of which is 11, and the youngest is 6 months or something. Anyway, so she got stuck there, but she really wanted to go back. I mean, they do stuff. She said before COVID there was like, I don't know, like 100,000 Jews in Shanghai, something like that. Or more. It was like quite, you know, because there's a lot of expats and tourists and people come there for business and all kinds of things. So she got stuck and then eventually made it back. Now, made it back, she was able to go back, to open the doors, but it was very, very strict rules. So as soon as they come off the plane, they ship them off for 2 weeks quarantine. They had to take a double test before they left. It's a whole very, very rigorous thing, right? And then, just towards the end of the quarantine, they took another COVID test, and for some reason, they all had positive tests. As soon as that happened, it was like, right away, ambulances, pack your bags, take the thing, all packed into an ambulance, they take you off to the hospital. They drive up at a hospital, 2-hour drive. After 2 weeks quarantine, which for them means you can't go anywhere, you can't do nothing, you can't open a window, nothing. Right? They come to the hospital and they tell them, no, this is the children's hospital. You say goodbye to your children. And so she panicked. That actually, God, thank God, didn't happen. She panicked, she begged, she prayed. And at first they were really, didn't want it. The guy says, this is our rules, you keep them. But they were going to call police almost. And she said, they tried the Israeli embassy, nothing. They gave her a big case why it really, in this case, is not going to work. And if you could ask permission from the higher authority, just put in a request. And an hour later, thank God, it came back that they can stay. They were the only people who were allowed to stay with children at children's hospital. So they got stuck there for like, I think, 6 weeks at least. Right? Wow. And
were they actually positive?
Good question. I don't know, but it came back positive. And they got permission to get food because obviously the kashrut, and right? So another one of the Chabad Shluchim there also was able to arrange food to be delivered. But she said, her kids were amazing. I mean, look, and that means like You can't walk out. You can't do anything. It's like you're stuck in a hospital. I mean, the only thing that has Wi-Fi. But her kids were amazing, and they said, look, what are we doing here? Obviously, this is there's a reason, and we've got to make it work. And she became, you know, a support for her children, she and her husband. And during, I think it was 6 weeks or 2 months, whatever it was, that she was in this hospital. Kept every day, they kept on taking temperatures and COVID tests and who knows what. And they decided to make a real experience out of this. And today, the kids still look back and think it was like the most amazing thing. She got them onto an online school in the afternoon. In the morning, they made a time for prayer, for davening. They made a Shabbos in the hospital desk. They put tablecloths. They managed to get something, and they sang things, and they shared divrei Torah. Things like that. And she talks about this concept of an anchor. In other words, this is an anchor. If you don't have a goal in life, you don't have values, then if you're stuck somewhere and you can't just live the enjoyable life that we like to live, then it's really traumatic, right? But if you have a set of values, you have purpose. Purpose is very preventative. That's what I'm saying. Besides the healing, it's very preventative because you always have a focus. And that focus, somehow you can modify and make it work anyway, right? Just at the end of the story, it's an interesting thing that came out. And then it was, as she says, she came there. She arrived in China to celebrate Hanukkah and ended up coming home to celebrate Purim, right? But what happened was, a few days later, COVID broke out there in Shanghai. And they went into a lockdown. Lockdown in China means like lockdown. Like you can't move, right? And again, she was very, very focused. So she, and they had a whole thing. So by that time, there were like 30,000 Jews in Shanghai or something. And they wanted to get matzah to all the families. So they have this matzah, this container that had come, and nothing was happening, right? Again, so they went into action, and they just like went crazy. They had food, but like lockdown was, you can't go anywhere, anytime. Eventually, they started doing deliveries and things like that. At the last minute, she worked heaven and earth. Last minute, they got a company that was able to take the matzah and container and deliver them to all the Jewish family just in time for Pesach. She felt, you know, she's in Shanghai. She's there for a reason. Like, you know, it's like not... And she told us they were all sending selfies with them with the matzah, and it was like very beautiful. Anyway, that was a good ending to the story. But the concept that I wanted to bring out today is that the sense of purpose became a real sense of anchor that just got them through, and got them through in a very, very healthy way. And she says her kids still... She had, like, you know, by the Shabbos table in the hospital, she had a bunch of Chinese kids who were obviously looking for love and looking for some parental figure. They used to come around the Shabbos table, so she had all these Shabbos table with her own kids and a bunch of Chinese kids. Yeah, so it's... Yeah. All right, now. The concept of purpose, however, from a Jewish perspective, right, the idea of having purpose is connected with faith, because what we need to understand that we talk about purpose and faith, there are a number of components. Now, none of these components are easy to implement, and I'm going to talk about that soon, because it's. Let me just define what it is. Let me define what I'm talking about, right? As I said, it's not an easy thing necessarily, but this is the Jewish idea, which needs work. It needs work, and it's a journey to implement, really. But this is what it is. The first foundation of faith is, we have as Jewish people, is that God is the creator of heaven and earth. He created everything. He's the only one that, the only authority, the only source of everything that we have. Which leads into number two, something we've talked about many times, and that is that we believe very strongly. Not always it's easy to believe, and not always easy to accept, but we believe very strongly that everything is bashkacha pratit. Everything is run by Him. Everything happens because of Him. The only thing we choose is, as we said always, is our response to what happens. But what happens is his doing. Thirdly, everything that God did is Him doing. Everything that happens is bashkacha pratit, but it's for a purpose, right? So God, we part of the strong belief is that God created everyone with a purpose, right? Which goes together with a Talmudic saying that when God creates us with a purpose, He gives us the ability, gives us the capacity, gives us the power to fulfill that purpose. Which sometimes is hard to understand, because sometimes He makes it difficult. Right? So we might have a set of values. We might have things that we subscribe to. Many of them are dictated to us in the Torah and the Jewish teachings. And sometimes He makes it very hard. He tells us to be joyous. He tells us to serve Him with joy. He tells us to do lots and lots of different things. And yet sometimes it's difficult. But we have this principle that if He gives us a challenge, it means we have the ability to overcome it. Not easily, maybe. But we have the ability, right? And fourthly, the principle is that we understand that everything that God does, some of it might be very painful, and it is painful, and it's okay to feel the pain, right? But not only do we just accept, we do accept, we don't ask questions, we don't ask why. The reason we don't ask why is because there are no answers. Because often he doesn't let us into the answer, right? But because we are here for a purpose, and therefore everything that God throws our way, good and sometimes not so good, or sometimes very painful, is part of the purpose. In other words, the hashkacha pratit and purpose go together, right? In other words, if I'm here for a purpose, that means everything that happens to me is part of that purpose. Nothing happens randomly, right? So everything that happened to me is therefore available to me as a tool of growth. Okay? Now, it's not an easy idea, this. Now, particularly it's not easy, and I think we need to mention this just to get a clarity and a completion of the whole topic. Sometimes it's incredibly difficult to believe that because sometimes what happens to me, you see, certain things that happen to us, painful things that happen to us, have nothing to do with other people. So it's an act of God. Okay, so we don't understand, God, why do you do this? Okay, but I accept it. And it's there for a purpose. But sometimes what happens to us has got to do with what other people do, the choices of other people, right? So if someone went through a very traumatic period of domestic violence, let's say, God forbid, or some sort of assault, or whatever it is, right? A toxic relationship, which have a lot to do with other people's choices. Now remember, we do say people have choice when it comes to their response. So if someone was violent to me, they have a choice to be violent, not to be violent, right? So that becomes very difficult theologically to really accept that what happened to me is hashkacha pratit, and what happened to me is for a purpose. Now, it's a separate discussion how we can reconcile those two things, because what that person did is their choice, their evil choice. They're accountable for it. They will have to deal with God on those choices. But we still have to believe that what happens to me is for a purpose. In other words, we have to believe, and again, this is a very deep discussion to how we put these things together, but we have to believe that God would never let something happen to me unless I could do something with it, unless it could be part of my purpose. Because purpose in Judaism is something that happens every day. Something that happens every single day. Meaning every single day we wake up, God gives us another day, so we should be able to fulfill that purpose or a component of that purpose, right? That's why I say that last point I made about accepting that everything that happens to me is for a purpose is much, much more difficult when it has to do with the negative choices of other people. And yet, that's something we need to try and get to. You know, recently I had a discussion with someone who had some challenges in their lives. And we were talking about God and faith, and she says to me, I believe in God, but I think God is good, right? So God is very good. So therefore, there must be another force also who, like, gives us the bads, you know, like the devil or something, I don't know, right? So first of all, I explained to her on two levels. I said, first of all, I mean, in Judaism, that's like a no-no, right? We believe there aren't two forces. There's only one. And although we don't like what God does sometimes, but it's all from him, right? Theologically, philosophically, we're not permitted to believe in any other force, any other power, any other control. But secondly, I said to her, I said, you know, even from a very rational point of view, I'd hate to think that I'm only in God's hands when things are going well. Right? That's a very terrifying thought. Like, you know, things are going well, I have what to eat, you have children, whatever the case is, right? Yeah, I'm in God's hands, that's great. And then suddenly when things don't go well, what happened? God ran away? I'm in someone else's hands now? That's a terrifying thought. I said, I'd rather think, just from a, even not from a spiritual point of view, or not from a theological point of view, I'd rather like to think I'm always in God's hands. I just don't always understand what he does. And I also don't always feel good about what he does. And I don't understand individually or globally or internationally what he does. It's sometimes hard to understand, hard to accept. But at least I know I'm always in his hands. And if I'm in his hands, by definition, God is not me and God knows what he's doing. So although that's, again, emotionally very hard to accept a lot of times, but it is a much more comforting concept, I think. Which means that I believe that every single moment of the day, I'm in God's hands. And I always am positive, and I have bitachon, and I have trust in Hashem that things will work out okay. But if they don't, God forbid, it's still Him, right? Like the Talmud tells us that there are two blessings. There are two blessings that we make. One is a blessing when something unbelievably good happens. It's called Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Hatov VeHameitiv. God is good and He does good. And then there's another blessing, which is we make it when there's tragedy, we make it when there's death, God forbid, and we say, we bless Him, He's Dayan HaEmet, He's the true judge, and He knows, He's got a plan, He knows what He's doing, right? Now, a fascinating thing. The Talmud says, Kashem Shemavarchin Alatov, just as we make a blessing for the good, so should we make a blessing for the bad. What does it mean, Kashem, just as? So the commentator Rashi says, it means we make it with the same sort of passion, same conviction, the same almost enthusiasm, right? That's an interesting thing. We're supposed to have the same passion and belief for the good and the bad, and yet they're not the same blessing, you realize, right? They're different blessings. One is a blessing for good, the other one is a blessing for
not so good.
And I accept it, right? And we're supposed to make them with the same feeling, but they're different blessings, because God recognizes that the good you relate to, you say, oh, you welcome it, right? And that's fine, it's a different blessing. And the challenge, it's another blessing because it's painful. So it's a different blessing, and yet we understand that it all comes from the same source.
Okay.
But when they say, just like you make a blessing in the good, so should you make a blessing in the bad, they don't mean to say the same blessing. It's a different blessing. That's what I'm saying. Because bad is painful. And God realized that it's painful. Yeah.
When do you bench
goyimul? No, so goyimul is more like when you go through a potentially dangerous situation.
That's, it doesn't happen.
And doesn't happen, so you thank God that it didn't happen. That's like showing gratitude. It's you made it through a desert, or a person was sick, God forbid, and got better, and that kind of thing. Right? So, I just want to share with you a couple of excerpts before I go to the book I mentioned last week. There's a book called Healthy in Body, Mind, and Spirit. And it's a fairly large book with letters of the Lubavitcher Rebbe on all topics to do with well-being, mental health, and so on. Very, very fascinating book. Now, it needs two introductions, because it's interesting when we read letters. I mean, there are, in Hebrew, there's like 30 volumes of letters of the Rebbe to different individuals, which are fascinating stuff on all areas of life and Judaism and so on. And they certainly create certain themes and very, very fundamental concepts and ideas. But obviously, it's always important to understand that sometimes specific answers written to specific people have context, and it depends on the person, depends on the thing, right? So even in this particular book, it's very interesting how the Rebbe addresses people's anxieties and people's tragedies and people's depression and other sort of forms of mental illness and health, and it changes from letter to letter, except for some underlying themes. When I say it changes, for example, you know, when a person writes or a person asks a question, they have going through a period of anxiety, for example. There's anxiety with a small A and there's anxiety with a big A. And you can see the difference. Sometimes the Rebbe just tells them like to get over it and have a bit of faith. And sometimes it tells them to go get professional help. Obviously, it depends on the level of the... depends on the question. We don't know... not always privy to the letter that was written to get that response, if you know what I'm saying, right? But there are some fundamental themes that come out in this book very, very, very strongly. And they have a lot to do with purpose, right? Purpose and faith. One of them are just a couple of different, it's a thick book, I'm going to go through everything, but just a little bit of, just a couple of excerpts that have to do with what we're talking about. For example, one person obviously was trying to cope from tragedy and bereavement and grief. And they wrote to the Rebbe that they cannot stop themselves from crying. So just as a side note, not the point I wanted to make, but one of the things that Rebbe says a few times in this book, and I've seen it elsewhere as well, that obviously when someone loses a loved one, God forbid, even in a tragic circumstance, obviously, there's a period of crying, but eventually you want to actually help the soul. And it's interesting that over-excessive grief and crying is actually not good for the soul. So sometimes as a motivation, we try not to do that for the soul's purpose. Not only for us, right? But for the purpose of the soul, which is amazing. But also we see a concept which comes up many, many things, which also channeling. So purpose also means challenging. And the Rebbe suggests to this particular person that they should every day, instead of wallow in the grief, they should take upon themselves to say a chapter or two of Tehillim. And I think what's meant by that is like channel your, you know, Tehillim is heartfelt prayers. Channel what you're feeling into something sort of more positive, right? But a lot in this book is talks about this concept of faith, basically, right? And she says that Jews, I'm just reading you different sentences, Jews also believe with perfect faith that God is the essence of goodness. And that God loves every person, men, women, right, as a father loves a child. And therefore, he says, the upshot of all the above is that all that God does is for good. Now, this is a hard concept. Because to really believe that everything he does is for the good, ultimately, that's very hard to understand. We don't always understand what that means, but we can try and reach a level where we understand what it, where we feel it on some behavioral level at least, right? Sometimes, actually, it's interesting, when I was reading this book, sometimes he's quite tough with people. That's very interesting, because anyone knows anything about the Rebbe, he's the most compassionate and empathetic, you know, with empathy, was like the most amazing, tolerant and accepting of a person. But he was also demanding of a person. I think part of that is not to do with the way he looked at every human being. He looked at every human being with, he always saw, he didn't see the external, he saw the soul of the human being. And when the Rebbe saw the soul of the human being, he also saw the potential of what the person could do. So you see it, I've seen it in a lot of videos where people come to the Rebbe, personally to talk, he used to have this custom of giving out charity every Sunday for people to give charity and so on. This was the time people could have a quick exchange with him. And there's a lot of videos, it's very, very fascinating. You see sometimes in the same conversation, it can be so non-judgmental and so accepting and then hit the person with a real demand, like you need to grow, you need to do something, you need to add, right? And you could see the way it was packaged. It wasn't a demand coming from a judgmental point of view. It was a demand coming because I see your depth, because I see who you really are. That's why I think you can do better. It's a whole different package. It's a whole different mindset, right? So, and you see it, and it was always taken that way. And that's why people never ever felt judged, and yet took the push from where it came. It was a push that came from respecting the person, from really believing in the person, right? And in these letters, you find that also, there were pushes, we spoke a few weeks ago, that there's a part of us which is pure. There's a part of us which is not affected by trauma. There's a part of us not affected by challenge, the depth of our soul, right? And I think that's what the Rebbe was saying to people, connect with that part of the soul. You can do it. You can do it. You need to believe in yourself. And that's why it comes across sometimes quite strong. And he says that, He talks about people are going through and they're having questions and they're struggling, and he says the answer is completely simple. When a person will reflect in a logical way about the creation and the order and precision and the laws that are to be found in nature, the conclusion must be inescapable. This is a tremendous system of order in the universe and strict laws, and therefore there can be no doubt that the world is regulated by a plan, an order and purpose. The very fact that there is order and purpose and law in the universe must lead one to the conviction that all is good. Since evil is the opposite of order and system and associated with chaos. So even though we think sometimes this chaos is full of chaos, it becomes part of the purpose. If it's part of the purpose, ultimately it must be good. Very interesting perspective. There's a letter, of course, when he talks about faith and thinking good and positive thinking. And then at the end, he says, regarding what you say about seeking psychiatric help, and he gives permission, not permission, I mean, he encourages that. He says that's needed, but that shouldn't be the focus. That's a healing component, but you have to really dig deeper within yourself to really build up who you are in terms of your faith and connection. Okay. Now, all of this, what we're talking about, faith and purpose, is true with trauma, it's true with small challenges, big challenges, it's always a perspective that is so healthy, right? However, as I said before, it's difficult to implement, and one of the things we always need to remember is when things happen, it's a journey. Okay, it's a journey that takes time. First of all, it's a lifelong journey, but even when one has a particular challenge or a particular traumatic experience, it's a journey. You can't just switch on the faith switch. It doesn't work like that, right? It's something you have to work through. But we need to know, number one, so it takes time. We need to give ourselves the permission to let it take time. The second thing, we also need to know, what are we working through? And for that, I know we've said this many times, but it's such an important that you don't just become, you know, it's all good and God, whatever. We make the blessing and we accept. But also we need to feel the pain. Because when we work through something, we need to know, what are we working through? So you first need to feel the pain of what you need to work through in order to work through it, right? So we need to feel the confusion, we need to feel the anger sometimes, we need to feel the pain, and we need to know that it's all part of the normal part of the journey. Thirdly, we also need to know that when someone does heal and uses faith and purpose as the foundation of healing, it doesn't mean that the pain goes away. Right? We've said that many times, but it's so true. There are certain things that are painful that remain painful. I think I told you the story of the people who started that organization for infertility, right? People of tremendous faith. And this is years and years and years later, they never had any children. And someone asked him, do you still feel the pain? And he said, of course. But he feels a tremendous amount of purpose and he said a tremendous amount of fulfillment because they channel that pain through faith and through purpose to build this amazing organization. So feeling purpose and feeling fulfilled and even feeling happy doesn't mean that the pain goes away. And that's perfectly normal. Pain, certain things, pain can never go away. Certain things they could, but certain things they can't. So I want to share with you, for the remainder of today, parts of a book which I mentioned this last week, parts of a book which I just read. The book is called Even If I'm Not by Dvoiri Kreiman. Now, a little bit of a surgeon's warning here. It is very heavy. Okay, I'm just telling you. Because we never compare suffering and pain from people to people, and whatever person goes through a challenge, it's their suffering and it's their pain. But what happened to this person is unimaginable. Honestly unimaginable. You'll see when I play the story. Right? Now, what's great about the book, you know, you hear heroic stories of people of faith and unbelievable people, and you always think, oh gosh, like that's not a normal person. I don't know if that's for me kind of thing, right? What's great about this book is that she's very normal. And that she is so real in communicating what she went through, her anger, her loss of her struggle with faith, her struggle with God. Amazing. But she takes us through the journey of how she worked through it. Now again, it's an extreme situation. Obviously, we always pray to God that He shouldn't test us. What happened to her is unimaginable. I don't know. I can only talk to myself. I don't know if I would pass that test. But she did eventually. And she's an amazing person. She now speaks all over the place. And she speaks about faith. And she speaks about her connection. And she speaks about her story. And I've said this many times, that we tell stories, obviously very extreme stories. Even if maybe we wouldn't be able to reach such levels in extreme situations. But it's something to learn from. And we can apply in a small way to even the little things that we go through, or the bigger things that we go through, but it's an amazing perspective. Obviously, I'm not going to go through the whole book, but I'm going to share with you some perspectives. Let me tell you who she is and kind of what the context is. So actually, I know her husband. He was a year older than me in yeshiva. We actually studied in the same yeshiva. They're a couple that live in LA. She was a principal. I think she still is a principal. She's a teacher. She's an educator. High school kids. Well known in the community. He does a few things. I think he's a scribe and he's a mohel. And they got married. I don't know her actually, but I know him. I was actually at her husband. I was at their wedding because I know the husband. We've lost touch a bit, but I know who it is. So the unimaginable tragedy that happened to them is as follows. They, unbeknown to them, was different in those days. It was just like a year before I got married. There weren't the standard testing, genetic testing that people do and stuff like that. And they, unbeknownst to them, had a genetic disease. They both were carriers of a genetic disease. And the first part is bad enough, obviously terrible. They had a number of children, some of which passed away when they were very young. So she gave birth 8 times and 4 children actually passed away, which was a whole nother part of her life. But that's not what the book is about. The book is about the next thing that happened to her, which was, after all that, as I say, completely unimaginable. She had 4 healthy children. The genetic disease they had was like a 25% chance when you give birth. And she wanted a large family and she tried to have children. She stopped eventually, but that's what happened. So then she had 3 daughters and 1 boy, healthy children. 2 of her girls were married. And then the boy, his name is Yossi. He was a good boy. He learned in yeshiva. Fun sort of guy, but also very studious and did some amazing things, and he got engaged. He loved nature. He loved sort of nature. And anyway, a few weeks before he was supposed to be married, he went scuba diving. Mm-hmm. He'd gone before, yeah. And an accident happened, and he drowned. Now you can just imagine. I mean, after all that she'd gone through, it's unimaginable. So the first 80 pages of the book, I'm sharing this with you because it's really such an amazing example of the journey, of this journey, right? And how we're talking about today, how faith and purpose, not easily and not without effort, but at the end of the day, carried her through and brought her to where she is today. So if you read the book, it's very heavy. The first 80 pages, you need some tissues. It's like very, very heavy. Filled with anger, bitterness, very real. She was a person who, before this happened, would daven 3 times a day. She didn't stop davening, she just couldn't. Only maybe some of the basics, perhaps. She didn't become irreligious, but she was really losing it in a very sort of, you know, was unable to function properly, didn't go back to school for a long time, meaning to her teaching. It was hard for even to go out and go shopping. She had an amazing network, amazing support. And then there's also a bit of humor here and there in the first 80 pages. One thing that's actually not humorous, it's actually sad. She talks about some of the things that people said during the shiva. We've talked about this once before. I don't know why people do this, but there's a golden rule. Show up and just, if you're not sure what to say, don't say anything. Just show up. Right? Did you have insurance? Or like someone said, my husband's a doctor. He says scuba diving is very dangerous. That was like such a... Yeah, as if I didn't know, that kind of thing, right? Okay. Anyway, all that kind of stuff. One humorous little story was that the first time she had... Her husband also went through his journey, but it's not so detailed in the book, but he was kind of a little bit stronger in a way, but he... So the first time they had the guests for Shabbos, which was months after he passed away, he walked into the kitchen and she was cooking and she was salting eggplant. And he said, why are you putting so much salt? So apparently, I don't know, my cooking skills are not so great, but apparently there's some way that you put a lot of salt in eggplant because it takes out the bitterness and then you wash it off. So she explained to him, you put a lot of salt because it takes the bitterness in the thing and I'm washing it off, I'll wash it off. And suddenly she feels that she's got salt blood. He's pouring salt over her. And she says to him, what are you doing? Yeah. So I'm taking away the bitterness. But it was like humorous, but she appreciated it. It was like, anyways, okay. So slowly, slowly, but she was determined. You see, this is the thing. I think this is what I tried to bring out in the last few weeks. The trauma is real and the bitterness is real and the pain is real. And you've got to give yourself time. You've got to feel the pain, but you have to have the underlying, even in such a situation, that the underlying determination to heal, right? To know that the choice is there ultimately with great effort. And she does that. She shows that. So she started doing different things. She incorporated all the things we talked about before. Like she went to different therapies. She did different physical things that were good. Different therapies that are good for trauma and stuff like that. Had an amazing network of people that came to her all the time. And she connected with them and didn't shut herself off. She did. She allowed them in. Good friends I'm talking about. There's a particular woman in the book called Fradl. I don't know who it is actually. Fradl Booker. But she was an amazing, amazing support with her. And also an interesting little just sidebar that comes out how you're supportive to people. You know, supportive to people means you have to be there to listen, you have to be non-judgmental, you have to just listen. But then also as a good friend, sometimes you have to be able to push a little bit. And you have to know that balance. It's like, it's very interesting. And this particular woman is amazing. Just throughout the book, you see it. How I know she's like a real, I hope so, I won't mind, this is like a real Israeli with a bit of a... with such empathy, with such greatness, but also a little bit of the Israeli strength, you know, sometimes to give a good push, right? Am I accurate? Is that so really, really amazing, amazing person. So she does all that thing. And then, of course, she deep down understands that intrinsically she still believes. Intrinsically, but it's not there yet. And wants to get to the point where she can, and she wants that faith to help her. But it's a journey, and it's very hard. And it's done very carefully. And I'm going to share with you just the next 15 minutes some of the parts of how it all happens. She has an incident where she goes shopping, but she can't. She runs out of the store and she goes back home. She calls this Fradl lady and she says, I screamed in the car like a mad woman, she says to her. I had this thought that I could be done with everything if I drove the car into a wall. And Fradl, of course, gets really scared a little bit. She says, are you thinking of hurting yourself? There's like, she says, no, I just wanted to be able to do that, all this kind of stuff. So are you sad? She says, no, I'm not sad. I'm angry, the whole thing. That night, her husband is really getting out of control. Her husband says, I'm going to call Rabbi Tauber. Rabbi Tauber is a rabbi in Los Angeles. I actually met him once. he's very good with these things. I'm going to ask him to come over to talk to us. So Rabbi Taub comes in the evening. He asks me, I'll read it. He asks me how I can help. So I say, it's also a lesson how you listen to people. It says, I say, Rabbi Taber, I'm angry at everyone. So he asks, everyone? Yes. All the people whose sons are alive, she says. Like, you know, she's admitting that she's, and she knows it's wrong. But she has that feeling, right? So she says in the book, I expect Rabbi Taber to tell me that anger is very bad. And the Talmud says it's compared to idol worship. Because when we get angry, we're denying what happened to us is from Hashem. She says about herself, when I was teaching, I created worksheets when I taught this years ago to my seventh graders. We cut emojis and anger management exercises, right? Also, you'll tell me that anger is destructive, especially since it's driven by envy, right? A pile up of ugly sins. And he doesn't say anything. She's expecting him to say all the, to give her a whole drush, and he doesn't say a thing. He just listens. Sometimes you've got to listen, right? So she says to herself, in for a penny, in for a pound. So she keeps going. I'm angry at my family, and Nachman's family, because they didn't get it. They hardly call. They went back to their lives as if nothing happened, which he says later in the book, which he knows wasn't true, but it doesn't matter. She was angry, right? And he just waits. He doesn't say anything. And then she keeps going. She says, and Yossi's bride, she just walked right out of here. Why can't she still be part of our family? Now, that wasn't true. She actually did kept in touch for many years, actually. She got married and had children, but, right? Anyway, he listens and listens and listens and listens, and then when she's out of steam, she says, finally, I'm angry with God. Yes, God, I'm angry with him. He did this. And then she's like, you know, she's gone through everyone, and she ends with God, and now she's angry with the world and everything, right? So he speaks very slowly, as if he's weighing every word. And he says to her, do you think King David was a tzaddik? No. So she says, of course, King David. I mean, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. Do you think David believed in God? Of course. So she says, if you open up a Tehillim, if you open up, right? He writes things like, you know, when he had problems with people who were fighting him. And if you look at a Tehillim, it is like this. I mean, I've had this experience where people have come to me and said, they tried to say Tehillim in English and it wasn't a good idea. Because they always had this notion about Tehillim, this book of Psalms that is so beautiful and it's songs to God and it's that King David weaving the tapestry of music and it's just unbelievable, right? And then you open it up and it's full of anguish. And the first things he says, my eye grew dim from rage. He was so angry about his suffering that his eye darkened. But at the end of the same chapter, he says, but God has heard the sound of my weeping and he's going to accept my prayer. Right? And that's, by the way, that is the theme of Tehillim. It's King David sharing the journey with us. That the feelings of anger and the feelings of anguish and revenge and hate are all normal, but you've got to work through it. King David always comes to the end. But I know God is going to make it good. I know I believe in God. I know that God is going to be on my side. I know He's going to heal me. All this kind of stuff. So that's why it's such a powerful book. For that reason. It's not powerful because it's all perfect. No, it's powerful because it's hard. Right? That's why we say to Him in times of challenge. So anyway, he says to her, he goes through this King David thing. He says to her, you can feel anger. That's okay. As long as you don't act on it. But he says, you know what? You must also feel gratitude for the things you do have. I say, I like that. Then he says, King David trusted. We trust. We are believers, the sons of believers. Then he goes and explains to her the Jewish concept that actually we have it in our genes to believe and to have faith. I say, I thought I did, but my emunah, my faith is now being put to a test and I'm not doing so great. And maybe it wasn't even real. So he says to her, no, losing children is beyond, just beyond. Give it time. And then he leaves. So Nachman is her husband, asked me after Rabbi Taub leaves, what do you think? And she says the following, she says, if he had told me to be grateful for when he first came, I might have exploded at him. But when he first explained about King David, it was very helpful. I have to work on it, but not tonight. Right? So that was the first turning point where she understood that's not just her. King David himself went through that journey on whatever that means on his level, but he went through that journey. Where those feelings are normal. It needs time. We do have faith, but sometimes the faith gets challenged and it goes to the background and we need to bring it up, right? Okay. Another part of the healing process is she goes to Israel a number of months afterwards. She goes to Israel for two reasons. There was some therapy that she wanted to do in Israel. And also she wanted to meet two people there. One was a woman called Sherry Mandel. Have you ever heard of her? She wrote a book on resilience. She lost a child to Arab terrorism. And the other ones was a couple called the Haymans, who had also an unimaginable tragedy. The Haymans had an only daughter who was killed in the Sabara pizza bomb. You remember the pizza? Yes. Yeah. And also an amazing, amazing people. Anyway, so one day she visits the Haymans and they sit down and they're talking and she quotes part of the thing. And she was already at the stage where she was more able to listen now and to sort of absorb and getting a little stronger. Also, very beautiful people, very loving people, very sort of accepting people, but people who could say to her things that other people can't because they had gone through it themselves, right? And there she asked them, tell me about Shoshana. Shoshana was the girl that was killed. She was 31 years old, the teacher, everyone loved her, she'd be visiting Israel and only stopped at Sabara to pick up salad and all that kind of stuff. So she says to them, are you angry with God? They said, no. Both of them said no. Even after she died? So Shifra, who's the mother, says, Hashem owes us something. This is powerful words, only they could say it. Right? I don't get what I want, so I throw a tantrum. We are not entitled. So she says, but I'm jealous of people that got to keep their children. And I'm ashamed of this. I don't want to be that kind of person. So he answers, he says, you need to understand that God doesn't make mistakes. Well, what other people have was not meant for us. And we said, we are very grateful. We stayed very close to many of Shoshana's friends. They invite us to their weddings. They call us when their children are born. And we're happy to be included in their life. So then she says to them, she's like fighting with them. She's like challenging. And she says to them, you know, I used to daven 3 times a day. Now I just can't even do even the basics. So he says to a very powerful thing. He says to her, don't be so hard on yourself. Because you're still in aninut. Now aninut is a term that is normally used for when a person passes away, any person passes away, and the loved ones, you know, sit shiva. But between that time when they pass away and the funeral, it's called aninut. It's a very shock, time of shock, intense grief. And at that time, you're not supposed to daven. You're not supposed to do any mitzvah text. You're supposed to just be completely focused on taking care of the funeral and the dignity of the person that died and so on and so forth. So she says, aninut, Yossi died 3 months ago. So he says, yes, but you haven't come to terms with it, which means you haven't laid him to rest yet. And if it's aninut, you're not even permitted to pray. Same idea. In other words, you've got to work through it. They told her the concepts, but you need to work through it. You have to understand, everything comes at its time. There has to be your goal, and you have it intrinsically, but you have to give yourself permission to do it slowly. And then she has a few things with them, but anyway, then she leaves. She was there with her daughter, her unmarried daughter, which is, her name is Bracha Leah. So she watch them get into our car and we wave as they drive away. Brachaleya, her daughter, says, wow. So she says, yes, wow. Then I say, let's go to the kotel. They go there and she picks up a siddur and she davens for the first time in 3 months properly. And then she says, that as we put our siddurim back, I realize I've missed the davening. In other words, she goes through a whole thing and she realizes that she had it in her, but she needs to get there. Right. So this is just part of her journey. And I want to share with you the last part, which is amazing. After a number of while, she has a married child living in England. And she goes there for Rosh Hashanah once. She goes for Rosh Hashanah to spend with her daughter. Now, you know, Rosh Hashanah, we've mentioned this before, one of the themes, there's two themes of Rosh Hashanah. One is blowing of the shofar, of course, but also there's the story of the Akedah. We mentioned a lot about the story of Isaac's commitment of going to offer up his son as a sacrifice to God, right? So she says, today when we blow the shofar, we remind God that Avraham Avinu said, I am ready. He was asked, take your son, your only son, and offer him up as a sacrifice, but it was only a test. So she writes like this, it's so beautiful. It made no sense. God promised Avraham that a nation would come from Yitzchak, and then before Yitzchak had children, he told him to sacrifice him. Wouldn't that undo all the work Avraham had done to make God's name great in the world? Because what kind of God asks that of someone? That's the whole point, she thinks to herself, right? She's working through it. Beyond reason, because he asked, and Abraham said yes. Then she writes about herself, she's a beautiful writer. She says, I wasn't asked. Was it because I would have said no? Don't take my son, my only son who I love. And then she goes into a whole bunch of things. Then she says the following. Today, on Rosh Hashanah, God asks us to ask for what we want. I'm asking right here, on the alien pavements of London. I'm asking for clarity, so I'll know where to go from there. Also for strength. I walk back to my daughter's apartment. I walk for almost 4 hours. Motti's friend, that's her son-in-law's friend, came to blow the shofar. I hold Meir, who's her grandson. His eyes are open. I concentrate. The shofar isn't just the whimper of a child before a father. It is also the victorious trumpeting of a soldier before the king, because Abraham said, I am ready. He paved the way for us, his children, to do what God asks. I wasn't asked before Yossi was taken. I'm being asked now to accept this, to say yes when it doesn't make sense, yes when it's impossible, yes because when God asks, the only answer is yes. Right? And that's where she came from where it happened until this conviction. And then the last chapter, she writes, it's now 3 years since Yossi died, and she was back in the classroom, and she realized she'd be missing this, and she gets back into teaching, and now she's really strong and healthy. Of course, the pain is going to always be there, and she's back in the classroom, and she's teaching the story of where God comes to Avraham and says, Lech Lecha, go to Israel, basically. He gives him a test. But the language, and I'll just finish with this, the language that is used in the Torah is when God says, Lech Lecha, Lech Lecha, if you translate it, actually means go to yourself. Lech Lecha, right? So she teaches them. She says, what does it mean, Lech Lecha? What does it mean, go to yourself? How do you go to yourself? And she explains what that means. You got to find your truest self. You got to find the reason for your journey in this world. But she says, before we can go to, we have to go from. And she ends the chapter by saying, going from, going to, grief and growth, led by the Parsha teacher, who is also a mother, learning, journeying, because if you are in pain, then Hashem is very close. And that's how she ends the book. So the concept is, I just wanted to share that with you because it really brings out the whole thing. So just to summarize what we said before, she only, at the end of the day, she only got to where she is today. I mean, after such an unimaginable story, the only reason, with all the therapies and the connection, everything which are critically important, she only got to where she is now because of faith. But that takes a long time. We all have it within us. But that acceptance, that journey, that coming to terms, that everything that God does. Okay, with small little things, you know, if someone cuts off in traffic, or even if we, you know, we didn't get the promotion wanted at work, whatever the case is, it doesn't need to take 3 years. But you know, that can take less time, right? But knowing that's all Hashgacha Pratit, and it's for a reason, and we can use it for growth and so on. But it can even be used in such an unbelievable story, but it takes longer, and it takes time, and it takes work, and it takes people who have empathy to listen to you and to support you, and it takes working through it. But it's that final thing where she understands that at the end of the day, we don't have a choice. Whatever God deals out for us, we obviously pray that it should always be good and reveal good. But whatever He deals out for us, even if it seems impossible, we can also be like Abraham and say Hineini. And the way we do that is the way she ends the book, by doing Lech Lecha, by digging deeper than ourselves and remembering that beneath all those layers of sometimes anguish and pain, we have that faith. We have that spark. We just have to connect to it. And sometimes it takes very long. But it's that spark, that discovery of that spark, that ultimately carries us through, because then we realize that nothing, it's not random. We're always in God's hands. And with work, with a lot of work, and with a lot of acceptance and belief, we can turn that all into, and channel that all into purpose and meaning, even if the pain remains. So that's just the final thoughts on this subject. Again, the next 3 weeks, we're going to do just one-off topics. And don't forget about Purim Tuesday morning. I'll send out all the details a little bit later. Have a wonderful day.